Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Adam Schefter tweeted, quote, Philadelphia has agreed to trade Carson Wentz to the Indianapolis Colts in exchange for a 2021 third-round pick and a conditional 2022 second-round pick that can turn into a first, league sources tell at Mort Report and me. So Adam Schefter had that tweet. There you have it. Wentz is going to the Colts. He's going to reunite with Frank Reich. He's got a chance to salvage his career, turn it around, get back on track. And if you believe the reports, he got exactly what he wanted. What he wanted was to go to Indy. What he did not want was to go to Chicago. So Wentz ends up in a better spot. He wins. He gets over. He gets over. But I'll tell you who else really got over. Chris Ballard. Correction. Chris freaking Ballard. What a genius move that is, right? I mean, this guy's a damn genius. He just got Carson Wentz for a third-round pick and a conditional second. He knew that Wentz wanted to be a Colt, and from the sounds of it, he didn't get into a bidding war with the Bears either. He might as well have just gotten a 28-year-old franchise quarterback for a third and a conditional second, if this guy is what he still thinks he is. It's brass as hell. Even if he's not a franchise quarterback, they just made a very good move without having to mortgage anything at all. I mean, if that works out and Wentz does turn his career around, then Ballard is a genius. If Wentz can't turn it around, Ballard really hasn't given up that much at all. And he's still a genius. So I guess what I'm saying is this guy's a genius. Wentz got what he wanted. Ballard got what he wanted. And the Eagles did not get much for their guy. And the Bears get nothing at all. That sounds like a pretty good deal all the way around. Except for the Bears. I do love that for Indy. They don't give up a first or a second this season. And it only turns into a first if this guy turns out to be who they think he is. And again, he's back where he had, or he's back with somebody where he had his most success. Frank Reich. And I'll tell you another key. The thing that Wentz has going for him in Indy, he's got one of the best offensive lines in football. Yeah, this guy's jacked up mentally right now. He's got swagger, confidence problems right about now. But he's got a head coach and an offensive line that you can trust. And that's the best way to get back your mojo. And Ballard is the man. And we'll see what Wentz has left. I love that deal for Indy. Love that deal. 1-800-636-8686. And Chicago gets jammed again, and Philadelphia does not get nearly what they wanted. Wentz does, Indy does. All right, so what are your thoughts? Hit me up. 1-800-636-8686. That's not the way that I thought that I would start the show. You got to go with the news, right? But the way that I thought that I would start the show is a topic I really want to get to. And that news broke last night. I led with the news that broke this morning, but the news that broke last night was as follows. Fernando Tatis Jr. and the Padres agreed to a contract extension. And not just any contract extension, but one of the biggest contract extensions in the history of American sports. That big. 14 years. 14. Bam. $340 million. Bam. More than a third of a bill. And I'm going to say this right now. And for a lot of you, it's a reason to go. I said this when Patrick Mahomes signed his monster deal. And I'm going to say it again right now about Tatis. Yes, it is hellified Jack. Hellified Jack. And he's still underpaid. Yeah, I said it. Even at 340 mil. Still underpaid. And I'll say this as well. Every other team in Major League Baseball ought to be chipping in on that deal. And they should be hitting their knees every single night and giving thanks to Fernando Tatis Jr. Because it's not just about the Padres. This is also about the sport of baseball overall. This guy is the face of baseball. He is the most electric player in the game. And I say that knowing that Mike Trout is still in the game and Mookie Betts is still in the game. I know exactly what I'm saying when I say that. That's how good Tatis is. And I know the doubters will come in here and say, yeah, but the guy just turned 22. He's appeared in a total of 143 Major League games. That's not even a full season. The team is already giving him a third of a billion. They'll say that he's too much of a show-off, a look-at-me type. And I'll say, if that's your take, if that's what you think about this guy, you're an idiot. Everything that this guy has said and done is about the right thing. It's about winning. He said it before last season.
We're just going to aim for the big cake, and why not? Let's go win a World Series.
We're just going to aim for the big cake, and why not? You know, you might say San Diego should have waited longer. That Mike Trout was 5 years older when he got his fat contract. And so is Mookie Betts. They'll say San Diego needed more time. Me? I'm going to say it's about freaking time. It's about time we had another Major League Baseball team that actually was doing everything they could to win games. About time that we had a Major League team that was actually thinking about the standings instead of the bottom line. About time that MLB teams stopped cutting corners and started to try to compete instead of trying to keep elite prospects in the minor leagues for longer than necessary so they can jack with their service time and keep them away from big contracts for even longer. The Padres did not do that with this guy. They could have. Most people would have, but they didn't. And I'm guessing that might be one of the reasons why they were able to get this guy for what they got him for. Because they weren't jerking with his service time. Like, I don't need five more years to know that this guy's the real deal. I needed one moment. Only one moment. And you know what moment I'm talking about before I even get to it. Yeah, but hell, let's get to it anyway.
Tatis! He's going to lead SportsCenter. He's done it again. Another home run, and the Padres add to their advantage. An opposite field shot that he knew from the get-go, and a bat flip amidst the flashing lights.
Credit ESPN and that home run. And more importantly, that bat flip was an iconic moment. It's the cover of MLB's video game. That's how special this guy is. As a 21-year-old, he already has a signature moment. Not just of his career, but for the entire franchise. I mean, that's right up there. Right up there with every other great moment in Padres history. That moment alone was practically worth a third of a bill. And the thing is, it was his second home run of that game. The home run was so great. It's easy to forget what happened before that. It's easy to forget. The Padres were down 6-2 in the bottom of the sixth against the Cards. They had already lost game one. They were running out of outs. They needed somebody to step up. They needed a hero, and Tatis was just that.
The 2-2. Fernando, a high fly ball to deep left field. Carr rushed. Ball going. Long on for El Nino. Won't be his last playoff appearance, won't be his last playoff home run. Now we got a ball game right here. A one-run lead for the St. Louis Cardinals. Here come them boys.
Padres radio. So that was the spark that got them back into that game and into the series. Because then, as you'll recall, Manny Machado followed him with a game-tying bomb. San Diego suddenly off life support and dangerous as hell. Then they advance and they set up that showdown with the Dodgers. But it wasn't just what Tatis did to the Cards in the postseason that got him that deal. There was also his humiliation of the Rangers back in August. Do you remember that? He came up with two men on in the seventh, and he did this.
1-0 is laced towards the gap in left center field. That ball is back, and it is gone! Fernando Tatis Jr. in a line drive, three-run home run. Get out of here in a hurry. He's into double figures in home runs. That's number 10 of the season. And the Padres jump on top 10-3.
Padres TV there. That did make it 10-3. Then Tatis went absolute legend when he came up the next inning with the bases loaded.
This is in the air to right field. Back it goes. Nando has done it again. Fernando Tatis Jr., a grand slam. And the Padres go on top 14-3. Two home runs, seven RBIs for Fernando Tatis Jr.
Padres TV, I want to make a point here too. The best thing about that Grand Slam was not the fact that it was his first career Grand Slam, nor was it the fact that a 21-year-old, had just smashed two home runs and taken over the MLB lead in home runs in that moment. Nor was it about the distance or the exit velo, although both were great. It was about the fact that he absolutely pantsed the game of baseball and the code, because the Rangers took that moment horribly. They threw behind Manny Machado when he stepped in. Then they cried about it after the game, and they looked so dumb. I mean, really dumb. And everybody knew it. That marked a moment of change for the sport, that the old way of doing it should be over and might very well be over, and that the new way, like, I don't know, the fun way, the exciting way, the right way was here. It wasn't all about pitchers throwing bad pitches, giving up home runs, and then getting all red-assed about it. It was about a 21-year-old kid out there mashing, having a great time, bringing excitement to a sport that has been thirsty for it for years. And honestly, a sport that seems to go out of its way to get into its own way. A sport that polices itself to take all the fun out of it. And here's Tatis saying, hell no, we're going to have fun. We're going to win, and we're going to dominate, and we're going to have fun. And then he backed that up the next day when he stole third base with a 6-0 lead off the pitcher who threw behind Machado, which was so awesome. And there's still so much more. How about that bomb back in San Diego?
And he hits a high drive to deep left field, down towards the pole. That ball is up, and it is gone! On top of the Western Metal Supply Company building, Fernando Tatis Jr. has left the field, literally!
I mean, that was a home run. Literally.
Literally!
He left the stadium with that shot. Literally.
Literally!
He's a major freaking star. Literally.
Literally!
This guy's must-see TV. Literally.
Literally!
I've said it before, I'll say it again. I don't care who the Padres are playing. I don't care what the score is. I don't care what inning it is. If Tatis is digging in at the plate, I am sitting down in front of a TV, literally. Because
literally!
You never know what's going to happen. And the fact that he is in San Diego now for more than a decade to come is awesome. It's tremendous news. And again, not just for the Padres, not just for San Diego. But you know what that means? It means we've got the Padres v. Dodgers. That rivalry is going to go to another level. The Dodgers are the defending champs. They added Trevor Bauer. They re-signed Justin Turner. They've got a stacked lineup and a killer rotation, and they're spending money. The Padres have already thrown down on Manny Machado and Tatis. The battle is on. Big brother has the ring. Little brother is coming to get his. And the rest of the National League has been put on notice. This could be a golden age for the five freeway for a decade or more. And if you're going to complain that Tatis is too young for a deal like this, then you're a dope. In fact, if you've got any problem with this deal at all, you've got a problem with you. This is great for Tatis, great for the Padres, great for SoCal, great for baseball. This is why I'm spending so much time on this national program hyping what would seem like a regional rivalry. It's much bigger than that. What I'm saying is the Padres are aiming for the big cake, and they've got a big-ass knife, a big-ass plate, and a kick-ass shortstop who looks like he's going to go down as an all-time great. And if you have a player like that, you don't jerk with it. You lock him up, you pay him what he's worth, and you be thankful that somebody else was stupid enough to trade him in the first place. I absolutely love the player, and I love the deal. Can you tell? And as I go to break, let me leave you with this thought. San Diego, get off your ass. Pick up the phone and call the only human with more game than Nando Tatis himself. Me, the butter knife. That's what I'm saying. Pacific Beach, are you ready to kick some Dodger ass? Old Time Mesa, rise up. Hey, Dodger fan. Tell me how my ass tastes. Probably not like butterscotch. Am I right, Lemon Grove? Spring Valley. Payback's a bitch. So are you, Dodger fan, a bitch. San Diego Superchargers. Oh, wait. They moved to L.A., didn't they? Hey, Justin Herbert, you couldn't hold Stan Humphrey's jock. I'm the butter knife. Put some bleeping respect on my name, damn it. Yeah, you too, Rome. Hey, Rome, they wanted to syndicate me, not you, but I didn't want to do it. I'm the reason you are you. You're welcome, Van Smack. Scoreboard, I win. You lose. Where's my song, Rit? San Diego.
You know, when I do that, I have to make a certain face. And now my face is stuck in that position. As I would tell myself, or as I would tell all of you, I'll tell myself, hope that was worth it, but I know it wasn't. All right, so Carson Wentz going to the Colts. An amazing deal made by them. Are you craving some protein after a good workout? This time, do not make a shake. Don't eat a bar. Grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Why Old Trapper? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and tender and made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. Old Trapper is a family-owned business which takes smoked beef extremely seriously, and you can taste it in every single bite. I mean, who wants dried, rough beef in a bag? Nobody. It's like eating an old shoe. Old Trapper, though, is the real deal, and it comes in four amazing flavors: old-fashioned, teriyaki, peppered, and hot and spicy. Next time you want a great protein and energy snack that you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper beef jerky. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. That way you can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Patrick Ricard is my guest. Pat?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Dude, good. Good. I'm glad to see you. All right. So normally I would ask you how you're doing and how the offseason's going, but I saw yesterday you tweet that your wife just started work once again, so you've got the house to yourself. How was that first day of just getting Pat time and having the house?
Yeah, I mean, it was great. She, we've been together quite often lately, and just for her to start her career, and, you know, and she's worked so hard to become a PA, so, you know, finally – starting her first, well, she started twice, so this is her first day back in a while, so it's just great, man, for her to start doing that, and for me to kind of just have the house to myself. You know, I had a friend come over the other day, we just hung out and watched TV, played little video games. It was a good day, and she's working again today, so it's another day off, but after that, she's home for a couple more days, so no, it's been a good offseason so far.
I was going to say, that is a good day. Good day for you, good day for her. Now, I had Kyle Juszczyk on the show a few weeks back, and we were talking about how he approaches the first few weeks of the offseason. When you're playing fullback, obviously, you're going to dole out a ton of punishment. You're going to take some as well. What about you? How do you approach recovering from the season when you start preparing for the next one? Do you take some time off, or do you get right back into it?
It's always take care of my body right away. So what I try to do is handle my physicals and all my, you know, exams to make sure nothing's crazy going on. So the offseason, I can just, you know, get healthy and then attack my training. So that's the first thing, making sure nothing's seriously going wrong with me. And then I probably take like at least 2 weeks off and just let my body just relax, recover. And then I start slowly getting involved in my training. I don't just jump right into it. I usually start out with like body weight and band workouts for a week or two. And then I start getting gradually more into the weightlifting. And then, you know, running comes along with it. I usually follow the head strength coach's program here with the Ravens. They send us a program to follow and the whole schedule, and I just follow that. And that's what I've been doing ever since I've been with the team, pretty much.
Man, that's a professional approach. I mean, that's a man with a process, and you're sticking to your process, Pat. What about nutrition? How, I mean, do you also take a couple of weeks off and kind of eat what you want, or do you not really deviate that far from what you're supposed to eat and what you're supposed to consume?
Right after the season, I mean, you got to enjoy yourself a little bit. You know, don't go super crazy because you don't want to get super out of shape. So when you start training again, you're just, you know, just killing yourself trying to get back to being in shape. So, you know, for sure, definitely, you know, have a couple meals you weren't having in the season, but it's nothing too crazy. You can't be eating that much either right now because you'll start gaining weight like crazy because, you know, we're not being as active as we normally are in season or training. So, yeah, I definitely take nutrition pretty seriously. I mean, you have to at this level. It gives you an edge or it can hurt you. So You know, try to stay on top of those things all throughout the year.
Pat, that's the thing. Seems like it, when you're in your business and everybody, I mean, almost literally everybody is looking for an edge, how the hell do you get an edge?
I mean, I think it's learning from guys who are quote unquote pros, right? You see what they do. You see how they've been in the league for so long, or you see the players who are great in what they do. You know, for me, my edge is doing the little things, the little extra things. I was an undrafted guy, so that's kind of been my MO since I've been in the league. I had to go above and beyond and do things that some guys haven't. So for me, recovery is so important for me in my game, especially nutrition as well. But, I mean, it's anything you can try to find that edge, regardless. Maybe it's film, recovery, nutrition. Maybe it's a new product or a new supplement. You know, there's so many different ways to get it, and I think that's definitely a key to long success in the NFL.
It's a good answer. To me, it's what you're saying to me is it's a lifestyle. It's a commitment. Like, you're all in all day, every day, except for that time when you take that time to rest or recover. When you talk about professionals, guys that you can learn from, guys you can emulate, there's a lot of guys in your locker room who are like that. Can you give me a guy or two who's a real pro that you respect, that you've learned from in terms of process?
Yeah, you know, there's two guys that come to my mind. They're both retired now, but they've had phenomenal careers, and it was Marshall Yanda and Eric Weddle.
Right.
I mean, those two guys, you know, they're constantly, especially Eric. I mean, he would probably work out in the weight room probably 7 days a week, and I'm not exaggerating. He's there every 6 a.m. He's in there. He's like one of the first guys was in there, and that was year, like, 13 for him. So it's just to see that as a young player, seeing that work ethic at year 13 and the career he's had, it just shows that he's a pro. And then same thing with Yanda. I mean, the way he just approached the game, just in general, just how his mentality of just flipping that switch on game day and just becoming an absolute maniac and just leaving it all out on the field. And, you know, those two things, everything Weddle would do off the field and in the weight room, he was always in the tubs every day in the sauna. You know, those things, and then the way Marshall just approached the game was just, that's how I kind of learn, and I take those pieces from different players and different coaches, and, you know, just try to emulate that and be more of a pro yourself.
Patrick Ricard is joining us. Pat, I'm glad you mentioned those two guys. Weddle's my guy. I remember when Weddle first came up, he'd been coming on this show for years and years and years. I absolutely love the guy. Yanda, I mean, you talk about a pro. What about the way this guy's completely reinvented himself and his body since he retired? When you look at that guy right now, what do you think? Because he looks amazing.
Yeah, it looks like he took 10 years off of his life.
Right.
He doesn't look like the same person. I mean, that just shows you his work ethic. I mean, for him to be, you know, a big guy over 300 pounds to just be a slim, fit-looking dad, like, out of nowhere, and no beard either. Like, it's just, it's insane. I was pretty shocked when I saw that picture. It was, like, right after retirement, too. He dropped that weight instantly, and definitely miss playing with him, and I hope he's doing well with his family right now.
Such a pro. And, like, he dropped that weight, like, in 60 days. Like, he retired and then had a plan and then executed the plan. Now, you go back. Right. Your story is amazing. Like, you're great to talk to because I haven't even gotten to the stuff yet. I can just follow you around, which means you're a good interview, so thanks for that. But your high school coach, Andrew Tuccio, was telling The Athletic, quote, honestly, his want and need is to hit. He went on to say that you and your brother Chris, quote, the two of them, it's like they had a button in their forehead. When they hit somebody, it was like an endorphin release. They were hit junkies. They wanted to hit people. That's like an amazing quote, actually. Is it like that? Is it like a drug? Is it like an endorphin release when you hit somebody?
Absolutely. I mean, we're playing a sport where we can be as violent as possible and you get cheered for it. I mean, you can't do this anywhere else. You get arrested on the streets or you get in trouble. For us, we get paid for it. We get, you know, you get scholarships, you get whatever. So growing up, I'm from a small town, Spencer, Massachusetts, went to a small high school. Andrew Tuccio comes in my freshman year, so he's a brand new coach, and he just kind of had that culture of, we're going to be a hard-hitting football team. We're going to be physical. We're going to be disciplined. And it was a close group of football players, and grew up with all these guys my whole life playing sports with them, and we had a bunch of different groups of brothers, like actual blood brothers. My brother, we had twins who was a quarterback, a running back. We had close brothers who were linemen. So we had all phases of the game, and we all loved to hit, and it was just that culture we had. And you know, and I just carried that throughout college and now in the NFL, and it just kind of embedded in me.
It's amazing. I introduced you as a football player, and the reason for that, you went to UMaine. You had a huge career as a defensive lineman, but then only two teams showed up at your pro day, and the Ravens weren't even one of them. At that time, what kind of thoughts were you having about the NFL, and how confident were you that you could play at the next level?
Yeah. You know, you can look at those things and be like, man, my odds are pretty bleak here. You know, what am I doing? Blah, blah, blah. But I think as soon as I signed with my agency, Buddy Baker kind of just gave me guidance and just like, just cancel all those noises out and just control the things you can control and just focus on what you can do right now. And for me, coming to UMaine, I knew it was, you know, it's a tough challenge to make it to the NFL, but I've had teammates that I played with, teammates that were there before me who been in the NFL, made it, had careers. So I kind of got to see, you know, what shouldn't you do, what should you do to get to that level. And, yeah, I mean, it was quite the journey for sure.
All right, so I want to be clear about this again. You had a great career as a D lineman when you were there. You go undrafted. You land with the Ravens. The story goes that at one point, offensive coordinator Greg Roman saw you in the hallway during OTAs. He said, quote, hey, I want to try you at fullback. I want you to line up. Just split the crotch of the tackle and kick out the first guy on the edge. End of quote. Is that how that happened? And if so, what was your reaction when he brought that up?
Story is very close. So pretty much I was in OTAs for about a week, my rookie year, only playing defensive line. So, you know, the coaches have, they've seen me for about a week and, you know, and weightlifting, running around and, you know, on practice or whatever. So, and at that point, Kyle Juszczyk, he just signed his big deal with San Fran that offseason. So the Ravens didn't have a fullback. So all they had was an undrafted rookie in my class as a fullback and then a running back who they're converting to fullback. And I think after a week, they kind of saw those guys, evaluated them, and thought, let's kind of see what else is there. Let's try to, you know, think outside the box. So a week later, Greg Roman approaches me in the hallway, like in the middle of the day before practice, and he's like, hey, Pat, we want to try you at the fullback. You're going to line up in the eye, and it's going to be like 90 lead. You're just going to go kick out you're going to lead up on the mic. I go, all right. And I didn't play offense in college. And the offense we ran in high school, I was a fullback and tight end for. It was a double wing offense, so it's not even a normal offense at all. It's all gap scheme. It's all very different than normal pro style offense. So I'm like, yeah, I'll do it. Of course, like I'm an undrafted guy, trying to do whatever I can to make the team. And practice comes around, rep happens, and for me, it was kind of just it felt natural almost, like I've done it before because I have played the position. So luckily for me, I made the most opportunity and I did a good job. And our three technique got in the backfield. I like shoved him as soon as the ball snapped. I like shoved him out of the way, let up on the mic, and our back just followed me. And me being smart, trying to make a name for myself, trying to make people around me notice me. You know, first week there, I stand right next to Harbaugh. As soon as the rep is over, I stand right next to him, and he's like, "Hey, that looks pretty natural right there." I'm like, "Yeah, I used to do it in high school." And I think as soon as I said that, he kind of just gears started turning in his head, thinking like, "Oh, okay, he's done this before. Okay." It looks pretty good. Let's see what else you can do. So then after that, I started to get, you know, a couple more plays as a fullback and a tight end because Greg Roman was the tight end coach and run game coordinator. But I was still playing defensive line. So that's kind of how the two-way thing kind of happened. And then, you know, the rest is history at that point.
It's an amazing story, actually. Patrick Ricard joining us. I was going to say to you, like, so you didn't play offense in college. You're learning a position, even though you played it, you know, way back in the day. But you're learning a new position in the NFL. But at the same time, you're playing defensive line. So what's it like juggling both those spots? I know you're going to do whatever you can to stick, but what's it like to juggle both those spots?
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot. I mean, I had to know. I had to learn the game plan for every week for offense, defense, and special teams.
Wow.
And I was a rookie, so I had to deal with all the rookie stuff, still going through an NFL season. And for offense, for me at that point, in high school when I did play offense, it was all gap scheme. We didn't run any zone. We barely passed the ball. We ran the ball like every play. So, you know, learning all routes, learning all different schemes, just different plays like zone blocking, you know, different things like that, and still learning some tight end stuff. And then it's like, oh, on top of that, you have to go do this against the elite players in the world who've been playing defensive positions their whole lives. Me, it's like, oh, this is your first time doing it, Pat. Let's see what you can do. And that's pretty much how it was. And I was just absorbing everything I could and just trying to get better on defensive line, fullback, and special teams. And I think the biggest thing, it was just a lot of communicating. I had to communicate with almost every single coach in the organization. Most players aren't like that. I was like John Harbaugh. I was going from starting out on special teams in the morning and then going from offense and then in the middle of the offensive
team meeting, I would go across the hallway and go to the defensive team meeting, and then I would go for the offensive walkthrough, and then I would go to the defensive walkthrough, and it was just, it was a lot. I did that for 3 years. It was a way for me to, you know, make be on the team, be active on game day, and I mean, it was fun. It was fun to do both, but I'm definitely happy to be playing one side of the ball full time right now.
So we come full circle. Honestly, I've never heard of anything like that before. Like, I had to learn all three sets, all three phases, the game plan for all three phases. So that brings us to where we are right now. You're a two-time Pro Bowler, and that's a hell of a journey for a guy who was undrafted out of college, who played a different position. I know you're not going to rest on your laurels. You made that very clear at the very top. But how much pride is there in what you've accomplished so far and the position you've put yourself in, and that you had to grind that out and earn everything?
Yeah. So for me, like you said, I had to really earn everything that has been given to me. You know, I had to earn a spot on the team. I had to earn playing time on game day. And then I had to earn a second contract, earn a Pro Bowl selection, earn it again. And that's just kind of how I've been approaching it. Just every year trying to prove myself. And, you know, it feels amazing. I mean, I never thought I'd be in the NFL. And now here I am financially doing okay for me and my family and making a name for myself and my town. And so many people look up to me. And I think the biggest thing, you know, with the Pro Bowls and, all, and everything like that is just respect. I think players are starting to respect me, fans, coaches. And I think that's the biggest thing. I mean, people respect your game. Like, nothing else really matters. You know, I'm obviously going to try to win as many games as we possibly can, but people respect who I am and how I play. Then, you know, there's nothing bigger than that, I think.
It sounds kind of cliche and trite, like something people say but don't mean, but you can't put a price tag on that, right? Respect, you cannot put a price tag on respect. And then finally, I would say, I bet I have to think you approach it as if not only do you have to earn it and re-earn it, you got to earn it every single day, right? Every single day.
Yes. Yes, I mean, every single day you're in the building, they're trying to replace you. And you have to perform at a level to where they're not going to replace you. You're not going to give them a reason to replace you. So it really... it can be stressful, but that's the business, and that's how it is. I mean, it is what it is, and you just have to be on top of your game mentally, physically, emotionally, everything, because there are people who are trying to come in here and take your job, and there's people whose job is to find someone to take your job. So, you know, it's just a blessing, and just be grateful for every day to have this job.
That's a great message. I love that message because, like, you know how it was when you were coming up. You were trying to stick and take somebody's job, and now you know somebody's trying to take your job. And as you pointed out, there are people paid to find people to take other people's jobs. Extremely well said. Patrick Ricard, my guest. Pat, really appreciate it. That was fun. That was a great interview. I usually don't keep guests that long, but you were rolling, so I want to play that hot hand, too. Let's make sure we do that again soon.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
That was a blast. So we're talking about the quarterback carousel in the NFL. Carson Wentz on his way to Indianapolis. And I mentioned, in case you missed that, what a great deal for him, what a great deal for them. But especially what a great deal for them. Not a great deal for Philadelphia. They didn't get what they wanted. And certainly not a great deal for Chicago. They get nothing. They get shut out. He obviously wanted nothing to do with them. And if you're a quarterback, why would you? Speaking of quarterbacks, wouldn't you think that in an offseason, they could have big-name quarterbacks on the move? That the one guy who'd be safe would be Ben Roethlisberger. I mean, come on, the guy's been there forever. Forever. I'm pretty sure that he backed up Terry Bradshaw at one point. Don't quote me on this, but I think that I definitely remember him throwing passes to John Stallworth and Lynn Swann and handing it off to Franco Harris and Rocky Blyer. Like, do you even remember a time when the Steelers did not have Ben Roethlisberger? It's almost impossible. But from the sounds of it, that time might be coming pretty soon. GM Kevin Colbert had lots of thoughts about that. Quote, as we sit here today, Ben is a member of the Pittsburgh Steelers, end quote. Uh-oh! Talk about not committing. As we sit here today, Ben is a member of the Pittsburgh Steelers? When was the last time you heard something like that? Yeah, I know. In fact, it sounded exactly like that when the Rams were talking about Jared Goff. And the next thing you knew, he was on a plane to Detroit. As we sit here today, Ben is a member of the Pittsburgh Steelers. Yeah, what about tomorrow, Kevin? Let's not get into that just yet. As we sit here today. As we sit here today, Ben is a member of the Steelers. As we sit here today, water is wet. As we sit here today, the sun rose. As we sit here today, the sky is still blue. It's about the most damning update that you're ever going to hear a GM make about a player, especially a Hall of Fame player, especially a player who's done for that team what Roethlisberger has done for that team. I mean, pretty wild to hear that, actually. As we sit here today, Ben is a member of the Steelers. Right. As we sit here today, Ben is a member of the human race. As we sit here today, Ben plays the sport of football in the city of Pittsburgh. At least he has in the past. As we sit here today, Ben has two arms and two legs and a big fat head. Pretty clear the GM is not going to commit to any more than today. The thing is, today, Roethlisberger is 39 years old. Today, his contract calls for a $41.2 million cap hit this coming season. This is why the GM is talking about the immediate present and not making any guarantees beyond that when it comes to Ben. And that first statement was not the only one of his nature. He also dropped this one.
You know, Ben Roethlisberger is on the team.
Wow. Ben Roethlisberger is on the team.
You know, Ben Roethlisberger is on the team.
You know, Ben Roethlisberger is a football player, didn't want any of that.
Yeah, as we sit here today, Ben is a member of the Pittsburgh Steelers.
You ever heard a guy hedge harder or qualify harder? He is on the team.
You know, Ben Roethlisberger is on the team.
And that's not all. He had more.
Ben Roethlisberger did a lot of really good things last year, and we anticipate that he could still do some good things moving forward.
You know what I'm not hearing? I'm hearing a lot, but you know what I'm not hearing? I'm not hearing Ben is our guy. Ben has earned the right to play here as long as Ben wants. I'm not hearing that. I'll tell you what I'm hearing more of. I'm practically hearing the GM say, take a pay cut or hit the bricks. I'm practically hearing Ben Roethlisberger is on the team today, and he'll be on the Bears tomorrow. I mean, listen, this is a brutal business in that regard. We're talking about Ben Roethlisberger. He's been with the Steelers since 2004. It's like a billion years in football. He's won two Super Bowls. Wouldn't you think that if anybody could guarantee that they could go out on their own terms, it would be that guy? But even he can't. This is why I'm always saying that every player should get as much money as they can when they can, because it doesn't matter how good you are, who you are, the end is going to come at some point. And when it does, it can be really ugly, no matter how many rings you have. Even Ben Roethlisberger cannot decide or get to decide when it ends and how it ends with the Steelers. And the GM wants to make that very clear, because the next thing the GM says is going to be something like, hey, Ben, here's the deal. We'll keep you, but you play for free. And if you continue to dink and dunk and average 2 yards per completion, your ass will be in the streets so fast it'll make your head spin. How's that sound, big dog? I'll tell you how it sounds to me, personally. It sounds to me like this does not end well. And it almost never does. Any credit card can offer cash back, but only Discover matches all the cash back that you earned at the end of your first year. It's like getting one of those birthday cards that's shaped like cash, so you already know there's cash inside before you open it up. But in this case, it's stuffed with your first year cash back match, and you don't even have to send a thank you note. How awesome is that? Brad Underwood is their head coach. Brad, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
Oh, it's my pleasure. Glad to be back, Jim.
Good to have you back, Brad. Thanks for the time. All right, so you beat Northwestern on Tuesday night. Let me start right there, because that's a game where you got off to a great start, then you had some foul trouble, but you still managed to find a way to get it done. What did you make of how your guys dealt with their attempts, Northwestern's, to get back into that game and the way they finished the game?
Well, it had an NCAA tournament feel from this standpoint. It was a night that we didn't shoot the ball particularly well. We dealt with adversity. We had Kofi played four and a half minutes the first half. We got a couple early fouls for the first time in a long time. And our bench guys stepped up huge. And we maintained a nice lead, and give Northwestern credit. Chris does a great job, and his kids fought, and they made some shots. And, you know, you've got to find a way to win games when you're not at your best. And we weren't at our best. And Northwestern had something to do with that, but Those games happen in postseason, and I told our kids afterwards I was proud of them because, you know, everything's not going to go smooth in postseason play, and you got to grind one out, and that's what we did.
Illinois head coach Brad Underwood is joining us. You mentioned Kofi Cockburn, 17-10, which is pretty much right on his season average. You knew the potential he had when he first arrived on campus, but what does it mean to you to see the level that he has taken his game to?
Well, he's become really consistent. And that's the one thing that he was not last year. He had some big games, he had some big moments, but then he had some, you know, he'd go two or three games where he wasn't at his best. And now he's turned into a dominant force on both ends of the court, really every night out. And you know, he's moved up the scouting report of opponents. He's you know, he's at the top. People are trying to double team him, triple him, whatever they have to do. He's handled that with great maturity and. You know, he's a more confident kid. You know, the old saying, the best thing about freshmen is they become sophomores, is very true in his case. And you know, he's in better shape. He's physically just very strong. And you know, he's having a very, very, very solid sophomore year.
You know that thing, too. Like, the best thing about freshmen is they become sophomores. And the other old saying is you can't teach size. He's got plenty of that. It seems like from the outside, he's also got, like, a huge desire to put in the time, to put in the work. He wants to be great. He's willing to listen and learn. I mean, is that the case with him? And can you teach that sort of thing?
No, he was brought up that way. And, you know, he's a young man that started basketball so late, and he's a sponge. He just wants to absorb information. And he wants to be challenged. You know, there's not many kids today's world that, you know, coach, if I'm not playing hard, take me out and run me. You know, he goes, I got to get it ingrained that I've got to go hard all the time. My motor's got to be high. You know, he's a guy that constantly is in your ear about, okay, what I do on that play. You know, he just wants to learn, and to his credit, he's a very quick learner. And it's really a joy to work with somebody like that.
When talking to Brad Underwood, you know, Brad, if we were to go back to last season, there was a stretch in early February where you dropped four straight, but then you bounced back to win five of the last six, including win over number 9 Penn State. Assistant coach Stephen Gentry told ESPN that he did a deep dive on the offensive end afterwards. I'm curious, what did you and he learn from that, and did that carry over to this season?
Well, I think we had to figure out how to utilize really good guards along with Kofi. And make sure that we had the right balance. And, you know, Kofi's number one in the country in usage and ball screens. And yet you've got a guy that is a National Player of the Year candidate in IO. And you know, finding that balance, not being in positions to turn the ball over. We knew we had some different personnel this year than last year. And so it was making the adjustments. It's advanced analytics. It was putting all of that together with a system that we thought would best fit this group, and Steven's a very creative mind, and so it's been something that's been very positive, and we've got a nice balance of kind of a continuity motion, and then we've got our, you know, a lot of ball screen action.
Brad Underwood's my guest. Now, you and I have talked about Iowa in the past. One of the things that jumps out to me about his game is that he seems like he's always in the right spot at the right time. The way he describes it, quote, I'm a winner, and I look for the win at the end of the day. My closing instincts just took over. Some nights I don't have to score 30 for us to get the win, end of quote. So how different is he now from when you and I last spoke about him, and what makes him so unique?
Yeah, I think when you talk about Iowa, it's the winner things. It's not just a capital W; it's the whole word. And he does whatever it takes. He's much more patient this year. There's a maturity about him, being an upperclassman, being a junior. He's seen it all. He's seen every defense. He's seen every coverage. And there's a confidence that comes with that. He's an exceptional worker. And the one thing that translates with that is confidence. So you put confidence to go with experience, and now you've got a guy that, you know, feels like he doesn't have to go score 30. He can get his teammates involved. And yet, you know, a couple of games ago on the road at Nebraska, you know, last 4 minutes, and he goes, I got this. And he had it. I mean, he scored 14 straight and made a couple of passes that led to other baskets right after that. So, you know, he's a guy that's had a triple-double this year, the third one in our school's history. You know, he can do everything to help win, and he is the ultimate definition of a winner.
So that confidence you speak of, I mean, does he show up and he just had that already, or does he have that confidence because of what you just said? He's an exceptional worker.
Both. I mean, he's always been a very confident young guy in his ability. And I think the one thing that happened, you know, you get rocked. You know, you come to college as a freshman and everybody tells these kids today they're one and done, they're this or that. Well, all of a sudden you get to college, you find out it's really hard. And he got rocked. But he is such a high character kid. That didn't faze him. That just said, okay, I've got things to work on. And he goes and puts that time in. And with that now, those aren't weaknesses anymore. Or those, you know, he's added 30 pounds. He's added, you know, 8 inches to his vertical jump or 9 inches. He's added, you know, he couldn't bench 185 when he got here. Now he does it 18 times. All that comes with confidence and hard work. And that combination of having dealt with some bumps in the road gives him that confidence today. I've put in the time. I know what's coming.
We're talking to Illinois head basketball coach Brad Underwood. You know, Brad, you guys are among the leaders in adjusted offensive efficiency and three-point shooting. I'm curious, what's to say about the coaching staff and the players that you could take such an enormous step this season and do so in the middle of a pandemic? How did you do that?
Well, I think it's good players, you know, and I think it's finding the right group. You know, that they're committed. I think I've always got the saying, we take character over characters. So I think it reflects on the character of our locker room. The guys that are in there, we've become old in terms of old, you know, not a young team anymore. Last year we were really young. We are starting a freshman this year, but we're still a team that is more mature, has a lot of experience. So those guys were able to pick up, they understand. When we made the adjustments and tweaks, they knew exactly what we were trying to do and why. And, you know, and then they work. So, you know, that combination has been pretty doggone good for us.
So finally, where does that leave you now? For instance, it's a program with so much history and so much tradition, but it did have some struggles in recent years. You and I have talked since you arrived. What was the vision that you had for the program when you first got there, and how close are you to realizing that vision now?
Yeah, I'm really proud of that, Jim. When I took over, the Associated Press, I think, named it the 11th ranked program in the history of college basketball. And for whatever reason, there could be a million of them. The program had suffered. We went to the 2005 Final Four. And to me, we've just now got this back to where it belongs. And we've got great fan base. We've got 15,500 every night in a non-pandemic year. Passionate basketball fans and a university where it's important. And, you know, I'm excited that we've gotten the level of basketball back to where I think it should be, you know, each and every year. And I know there's off years and I know there's great years, but this is a great program and I'm excited to get this thing back to where it, in my opinion, it should be.
Taylor Heineke is my guest. Taylor, it's great to have you on. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Man, I'm great. And I'm anxious to talk to you first. Let me rephrase that question. You re-signed with Washington last week. So how are you doing and how is your life right about now?
It's definitely different. You know, I've talked to, you know, many people about, you know, the past 5 years of my journey, and I've always felt like I've had one foot in, one foot out, kind of just battling my way in, trying to just stay in the league. And, you know, now it kind of feels like I'm finally have my 2 feet in. You know, a little bit of sense of security there, you know, 2-year contract. So it feels good. You know, all the hard work's paying off, and hopefully this is just the beginning.
You know, it truly is an amazing journey. For instance, if we were to go back to December, I mean, as recently as December, you were back at Old Dominion. You were taking math classes after being out of the league since 2019. The story, Taylor, goes that you were taking mathematics in nature, number theory, discrete mathematics, applied numerical methods, and partial differential equations, whatever any of that means. Like, what was your life like at that point?
Yeah, you know, from the summer until December, I was trying to figure out what plan B was. I kind of gave myself that time frame where if I didn't get a call this year, it was time to hang them up and move forward and find the next thing to do. So, you know, I kept on training every day, and with the slight, you know, glimmer of hope in the back of my mind that, you know, an injury may happen or something COVID related might happen. And, you know, sure enough, here we are. And again, you know, if someone told me this is going to be the deal in January and February, you know, 3-4 months ago, You know, I would have took it all day. So, again, you know, a lot of good things happening here, but, again, hopefully it's just the beginning.
Taylor Heinicke is joining us. All right, so what about that moment? Washington signs you to the practice squad on December 8th. What do you remember about that moment? What were you thinking then?
Yeah, I was actually in bed watching a movie, and I remember my agent called me, and the first thing he says is, you know, you ready to play some football again? And, you know, I was pumped up, you know, I found out it was Washington. And, you know, the main reason they brought me in, as many of you remember, is when Denver had that COVID-related problem where they had a receiver play quarterback. Well, you know, Washington was thinking about that situation and thought I would be the good quarantine quarterback. So I was up there in practice squad, kind of, you know, had to keep my distance away from everybody. I was, you know, sitting in the back of team meeting rooms and staying 10 yards away from everyone at practice. So it was a bit different, but, you know, with some things that happened here and there, you know, I was thrusting to the active spot and playing in the playoff game. So, you know, a lot of things were moving fast. A lot of things happened pretty quickly there. But, again, you know, I wouldn't have it any other way.
You know, they made it very clear to you. In fact, Ron Rivera, who you had already played for, said, hey, you stay away from everybody. We cannot afford to have another issue. You need to stay away from everybody. And then you get the opportunity, and then all of a sudden you find yourself getting ready for that playoff game against Tampa Bay. I mean, you saw some action against the Panthers, and then you get the word that you're going to start a playoff game. And it was clear throughout that game you were ready. You were prepared. How do you explain that? How were you so ready for that big moment in the big stage?
Well, you know, when I wasn't in, I kept on envisioning myself having success, and I think that had a big thing to do with it. You know, I kind of envisioned myself in scenarios like that and being successful. So when that time came, I felt like I was ready for it. And again, you know, I was with Scott Turner in Minnesota. I was with him in Carolina. So learning the playbook wasn't difficult for me. It was something I was already accustomed to. You know, I kind of already knew the offense pretty well, which is, you know, a big thing at this level. So when I came in, I kind of took off where I left off with that offense and didn't miss a beat. So again, you know, the biggest thing for me in those 3 to 4 weeks was just trying to get the timing with the receivers. You know, obviously they've gone through a long, hard season. They were tired, so I didn't get any full speed reps. So, for instance, the first time I was throwing to Terry McLaurin was in that game. So, you know, I thought we did pretty well, though, you know, and again, something to build off of for next year.
That's amazing when you say that, because I was going to read you a quote from him. And what Terry said after the game was, quote, I take number 4 on my team any day of the week and twice on Sundays. I hope that we can be teammates in the future. The dude plays with no fear. I mean, to have a guy like that say something like that about you is one thing, but to have that guy say something like that about you when that was the first time that you had thrown to him in a game is absolutely amazing. What's it mean to you to hear that from him and to get that level of respect from your peers and teammates?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing. You know, coming into a new locker room, you just want to gain respect. And I remember the first day I got there, I said, I want to be the first one in, the last one out. And I think when people walk into the locker room early in the morning, they see, you know, their quarterbacks and they're studying and trying to get ready. I think that means a lot for them. And, you know, again, yeah, I had a great relationship with Chase there. And, again, it all goes back to preparation and showing those guys that, you know, you care. And so, you know, it worked out really well. I think they really respect my work ethic, my preparation. And again, it's a good thing to build off for next year.
And then, Taylor, there was that now famous dive for the end zone in the third quarter that left you with that sprained AC joint. What do you remember about that play?
Yeah, so you go back and look at the play, and I probably could have just thrown it to my first read and the running back in the flat. But I guess, you know, for some reason I didn't, and I kept on going through my reads, and they had it covered pretty well. I just remember, you know, the defensive line was actually doing a good job of keeping me in the pocket there for a little bit, and I kind of squirmed around, saw a little hole, took it off, and, you know, once I saw that pylon, I kind of just took a beeline for it, and didn't necessarily know I, you know, leaped from the 4-yard line to get there, but looking back at it, it was a pretty cool play. Probably will say it might not ever happen again, but it was a cool deal.
Hey, listen, I'm not doing what I do. I'm not supposed to like fawn over the guys I talk to, but it was an amazing play. It was an absolutely amazing play to see, you know, even get off the couch after that kind of a play. But then you look at your story and it almost feels like something out of a Hollywood movie, but there are some other crazy, crazy things. Like there was that time at Old Dominion where you threw for 730 yards in a game and 5 TDs against UNH. I just want to make sure that I'm clear on this. That was in an actual football game, right? Not a video game. 730 yards passing. That happened.
Yeah. So it was my sophomore year. It was our first game in conference. And, you know, it was a good conference in the FCS level, that CAA. You know, you got JMU, you got Delaware, you got all those guys. So New Hampshire came into town. They jumped up on us quick, pretty early. They were up 24 points in the first quarter. And I remember the our offensive coordinator, Coach Scott, comes up and says, we're going to throw the ball every play and try and win this game. And I'll be okay. Well, you know, 79 passes later, I'm right there at 730 yards, and we come back and win the game 64-61. So that was really the beginning of it all. And, you know, just Coach Scott, you know, believing in me to throw the ball 79 times in the game, you know, it really kicked everything off.
Dude, how did your arm feel the next day? Were you hanging? Like, what's that like?
You know, it wasn't, because I was feeling good, you know, but you know, if we didn't win the game, it definitely would have been hurting a little bit more. But again, you know, when you throw 730 yards and come back from a 24-point deficit, you know, you feel pretty good about it.
So before I let you go, just to circle back, knowing everything you've been through and the journey you've been on and what you've gone through even since college, what does it mean to you to sign that extension?
Yeah, it's huge. You know, it's everything that you work for as a kid. You know, I dreamed of playing in the NFL. I grew up watching guys like Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers, and I was born a Packer fan. So I like to think that when I'm out there, I just try and have fun, just like Brett Favre was out there doing, you know, leaving it all on the line every game, just going out there and trying to win games. So, you know, for this to happen, and just 4 months ago I was taking classes, not thinking I'd ever play again, it's definitely a blessing. And again, I hope it's just the beginning of this wild ride.
So, I mean, Taylor, clearly you belonged out there. The moment was not too big for you, and you're in there trading shots with Tom Brady coming down. Like, if you grew up watching Brett Favre, admiring Brett Favre and guys like that and Aaron Rodgers, was there any part of you at any moment during that game where you're like, damn, I mean, I literally am standing in and trading blow for blow with the alleged GOAT?
No. Again, you know, a lot of people have asked me that, and – you know, it's kind of cliche to say that, you know, I'm not playing Tom, I'm playing the defense. But again, the whole game, I'm like, this might be my last chance. This might be my last opportunity to play some ball. I'm going to go out there and have some fun and see if we can, you know, pull out this upset. You know, no one was giving us a chance, so we had nothing to lose. We kind of left it all out there. And again, I thought we played a really good game.
Here's the last thought. I'm really struck by this, because doing three or four times in this conversation, you've said, I hope this is the start of something great. So how do you go about building on the last few months as you get ready for next season? What's your process and plan?
Yeah, I'm already back down in Atlanta, you know, my hometown, and I'm back to training already. So again, you know, I kind of look back at everything that's happened, and I'm proud of myself, but again, you know, I don't want that to be the peak. I just want that to be the beginning. So hopefully, you know, there's a lot more games like that, a lot more opportunities, you know, and hopefully, you know, the main goal is to go win the Super Bowl. So, you know, whether it's me starting next year or someone else, that's the main goal. So, you know, that's where my mind's at right now.
Signed that 2-year contract with Washington last week, more than 350 yards from scrimmage and 2 TDs in that playoff game against Tampa Bay. Taylor Heinicke, our guest. Taylor, great to have you on the show. Really appreciate the conversation. Hope we can do it again next season. Thanks for the time. That was nice.
Thanks, Jim. I appreciate it.
Appreciate you, Taylor. Great job.
St. Louis Battlehawks.
Rit.
Good night now.